From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we go back to an October 2019 cover story by Good Weekend senior writer Jane Cadzow on Racing New South Wales CEO and Australian Rugby League chairman Peter Volandis. The profile charts everything from his rise to power and iron fist rule to his curious relationship with the media as a dual sporting boss and eager mouthpiece. Today, Jane will be joined in conversation by Katrina Strickland, the editor of Good Weekend, along with Sydney Morning Herald chief sports writer Andrew Webster, for a discussion of Volandis' leadership and his push for a speedy NRL return. But first, actor Sarah Bishop will read the story in full, so take a walk or pull up a chair and listen to Eyes on the Prize.
Peter Volandis has a story about the time he went to Royal Ascot, the thoroughbred horse racing carnival regarded as one of the smartest events on England's sporting and social calendar. The Australian racing supremo wore a borrowed top hat, which unfortunately was too big. "When I stuck it on my head, it kept going down past my ears," he says. "Gay Waterhouse, one of our champion trainers, saw me having trouble with the hat, so she came over." According to Volandis, Waterhouse deftly folded a newspaper page into a strip and used it to pad the inside circumference. This worked a treat. "The hat fitted beautifully. Only problem, when I took it off, I had the word crisis on my forehead." He laughs. "No, I'm kidding about that." Volandis, 59, is a man of sturdy build and modest height. With receding dark hair, he wears slicked straight back like a character from one of the Godfather movies. Today, he will be at Royal Randwick in Sydney for the running of the richest turf race in the world, the $14 million Everest. His presence will also be felt in Melbourne, where tens of thousands are expected trackside to watch the Caulfield Cup, a race with $5 million in prize money and 140 years of history. Volandis is chief executive of Racing New South Wales, but the title doesn't fully convey his clout. More than a mere administrator, he is a mover and shaker, and his influence extends across state borders. "He has tipped the industry on its head," says James Mathers, a horse owner and former Equestrian Federation of Australia director. The venerable racing journalist Max Presnell has covered the so-called sport of kings for more than half a century, and it seems to him that Volandis' impact is unprecedented. "In my opinion, there has never been a more powerful man in Australian racing," Presnell says. Fast-talking, wise-cracking, as brash as all get out, Volandis does not impress everyone. Amanda Elliott, chairperson of the Victoria Racing Club, dismissed him a few months ago as a silly little man making silly decisions. Others describe him as a human bulldozer, ruthless, relentless, and dangerous if you get in his way. "You would be hard-pressed to find anyone in the racing industry who would be game to be critical of him," says Tim Egan, chief executive of the Newcastle Provincial and Country Trainers Association. "People are frightened of him." Even his admirers, and there are a lot of them, shiver slightly when they think about the consequences of falling out with Volandis. "I don't think I'd ever want to be on his wrong side," says Josh Blanksby, chief executive of the Melbourne Racing Club. Volandis insists his fearsome reputation is unwarranted. He tells me people who meet him are pleasantly surprised, often confiding to him that he isn't as bad as they expected. "It happens all the time," he says. "I'm not this monster they all think I am. I'm quite the opposite." The first time I meet Volandis at his office in the Sydney CBD on a September afternoon, his white business shirt is hanging out the back of his suit pants, and he has the air of a person too busy to tuck it in. He has just been elected chairman of the Australian Rugby League Commission, the ARLC, which means taking the helm of the sport's national governing body. As if being a racing boss weren't enough, from October 30, 2019, he will preside over a football code as well. What's more, he is in the middle of buying a house and selling his old one. "I had to get a bridging loan," he says. Financially, it's a bit of a strain, but you only live once. Money is for spending, right? You can't take it with you. I've never seen a hearse with a trailer. During our conversation, which is conducted at such breakneck pace that it is all I can do to keep up, he takes a call from his bank. "I've got 1 minute for you," he says briskly into the phone. After a rapid-fire exchange, he thanks the bank officer for her help organising the finances and reminds her about her invitation to an upcoming Racing New South Wales lunch in the director's room at Royal Randwick. Her partner is welcome too, he says. "And if you want to bring another couple, just let me know." The Australian racing calendar once had an immutability to it. In October and November, the important race meetings were in Melbourne. In autumn, it was Sydney's turn. Valandis, intent on making New South Wales the premier racing state, has trampled over boundaries with the insouciance of Vladimir Putin annexing the Crimea. He launched Sydney's assault on the Victorian Spring Carnival in 2017, when, with much fanfare, the Everest was run for the first time. This year, the scheduling of the race for the same day as the Caulfield Cup has upped the ante. Further marshalling in on the Victorian Carnival, he has created a new race, the $7.5 million Golden Eagle, and set it against the Victoria Derby. Both will run on November 2nd. The Derby has been a jewel in the crown of Melbourne racing since 1855. Its prize pool is $2 million. The Victoria Racing Club's Amanda Elliott is unamused. "This kind of single-minded determination to knock off Victoria just infuriates me," she has said, arguing that the two main branches of the Australian racing industry should work cooperatively so that the best horses can be entered in all the biggest events, rather than their owners having to decide whether they will run in Melbourne or Sydney. Valandi's response? "Why not completely rearrange the spring schedule and move the Melbourne Cup from the first Tuesday in November? After all, the Melbourne Cup will always be the race that stops the nation. It doesn't matter when it's run." The more apoplexy he induces, the breezier Valandis gets. "Competition improves everybody's performance," he says, pointing out that Victoria has responded to the New South Wales challenge by boosting its spring carnival prize money. The Victorian total this year is $102 million, up $18 million on last year. Melbourne Cup runners will compete for $8 million in prizes, $700,000 more than in 2018. In some ways, this is a contest between splashiness and tradition. Elliott, who declined to speak to Good Weekend, is a doyen of the Melbourne establishment. Her great-grandfather was mayor of the city and a member of state parliament. Her father was a Victoria Racing Club vice chairman. Her ex-husband, John Elliott, is a former federal president of the Liberal Party. In one interview, she gave the impression that her advocacy for Melbourne racing was fuelled by a sense of noblesse oblige. "Unconsciously, one inherits almost a responsibility to do something for this fabulous city," she said. Sydney Spiv versus Melbourne Toff is how you would headline a story about the contretemps between her and Valandis. Though Valandis actually grew up in the New South Wales city of Wollongong, where his father worked double shifts at the steelworks. To Valandis, a guy who shoots from the hip, the surprise is that Elliott was the first of the two to lose her manners. "Look, Amanda's a nice lady," he says. "I don't want to criticise Amanda. I don't know her that well either. I just didn't expect it. I was stunned." As a kid, Valandis yearned for a rangier frame. "True story, I used to hang off the clothesline trying to get taller," he says. "One of my ambitions in life was to be tall. So she did hit a nerve, I gotta say." Since we're on the subject, I ask Valandis his height. "It depends if I've got heels," he says. "But I'm about 5'9", 175 centimetres. I look at him sceptically. "So I'm not actually short," he continues. "But I've got very short legs, right? A normal person, it's 51% legs, 49% body. I'm the other way around. I'm 49% legs, 51% body. That may at least partly explain the extravagant length of Volandi's trousers. So much material is bunched around his ankles that you could be forgiven for thinking he picked up the wrong pair from the dry cleaner. In the racing world, where sartorial style matters, Volandi's is known for his almost permanently rumpled appearance. A leading sports writer last year had a good-natured dig at him for wearing $200 suits, ill-fitting shirts, and cheap ties. When I mention the article, Volandi's adopts a mildly aggrieved tone. "They're definitely not $200 suits, I can guarantee you that," he says. "I do get them on sale, I don't deny it, but they're pretty decent suits, so he got that one wrong." Rugby league spectators waste little time talking tailoring. Peter Beattie, the former Queensland Premier and outgoing ARLC chairman, believes Volandi's is the perfect choice to lead the sport. "This is a poor boy from Wollongong who made good," Beattie says. "I would have thought everyone out there who loves rugby league would love the bloke." Beattie, for one, regards his successor as a breath of fresh air. "Frankly, we need more people like him in public office instead of the wimps we've got now." Volandi's realises he has a big task in front of him. It won't be easy running both racing and rugby league. Or rugby league, as he curiously pronounces it. "People are saying, 'Are you mad?'" he tells me. "But I just felt as though I had this debt I had to pay. Because without rugby league, I probably wouldn't be where I am." When he, his parents and his two older brothers immigrated to Australia from the Greek island of Kythera, Volandi's was 3 years old. His childhood was marred by bullying, he says. "Really bad. You're a wog. I hated going to school because I didn't know from one day to the next what was going to happen to me. And what got me in with the Aussie kids was rugby league. I started playing and it mapped my life to a certain degree. Because I became an Aussie. I became one of them." By the time he gained acceptance on the football field, Volandi's was a hardened playground brawler, ready to take on anyone who slighted him. "I don't think I'm like that now," he says. "I've mellowed a lot. But those who deal with him say he still has a highly combative personality. In meetings, if he doesn't like what's being said, he'll just talk over the top of people," says one person. "He's the classic bullied kid who became a bully," says another. The stoush over spring racing dominance may be unsettling for Amanda Elliott and Racing Victoria Chief Executive Giles Thompson, who also declined an interview. But Volandi's gives the impression he is relishing it. Conflict invigorates him. "Put it this way, when things are quiet, he goes looking for a fight to win," says a New South Wales racing industry executive. Even by Volandi's standards, the row that erupted over his use of the Sydney Opera House sails to promote last year's Everest was a bruising one. He wanted to beam onto the sails of the building the horses' names and the numbers of the barriers, or starting gates, that they had drawn, along with the colours of their jockey silks and the Everest logo. Opera House Chief Executive Louise Herron knocked back the proposal because it contravened the building's illumination policy, designed to protect the World Heritage status of the architectural masterpiece. Volandi's and Herron had a phone conversation that ended in an impasse, and the next day, Sydney's The Daily Telegraph published a front-page story in which Volandi's accused elites of wrapping the Opera House in red tape. Radio 2GB presenter Alan Jones followed up with an extraordinarily vicious attack on Herron, calling for her to be sacked and saying he was going to get straight on to New South Wales Liberal Premier Gladys Berejiklian. Volandi's was on air with Jones and Herron during the tirade. "Look, I think Alan just lost it, basically," he tells me. "I don't know what got into him." Perhaps Jones's substantial financial interest in the thoroughbred industry fired him up. One of the race favourites, Shoals, was co-owned by his close friend and racing partner, John Massara, a leading thoroughbred breeder and former Racing New South Wales chairman. In any case, Volandi's ended up getting what he wanted. Within hours of Jones's mauling of Herron, Berejiklian's government had instructed the Opera House boss to allow a slightly modified version of the Everest light show to go ahead. More than 300,000 people signed a petition supporting Heron. Angry protesters gathered at the Sydney landmark, and Volandis got death threats. The Jones interview was a disaster for Peter. Says Barry O'Farrell, chief executive of Racing Australia and a former New South Wales premier. He wasn't the one who was bullying Louise Heron. He was a bystander to what was by any measure an ugly piece of radio. But some suspect Volandis orchestrated the whole thing. He has a cosy relationship with the Daily Telegraph. Racing New South Wales reportedly pays more than $5 million annually to have lift-out form guides published in the newspaper. He is also a friend of Jones. As Volandis says, the brouhaha significantly raised awareness of the Everest. "It got us a record crowd," he tells me. "It worked out at $25 million worth of publicity." This year, he negotiated with the New South Wales government to project the Everest barrier draw onto the Sydney Harbour Bridge, which in fact was where he wanted to put it last time. The government offered the Opera House instead. "The only way you'll ever beat him is with an axe," says horse owner James Mathers. On a recent Saturday, I find myself sitting next to Volandis at a sumptuously laid table in a glass-fronted room overlooking the winning post at Royal Randwick. Like the bank officer, her partner, and about 80 others, I have cracked an invitation to the Racing New South Wales lunch. Volandis holds these lavish events regularly, using them to bring together friends and associates in business, politics, sport, the arts, and the media. He is a networker par excellence, along with a few individuals he thinks deserve a day out or to whom he feels he owes a favour. He is an ebullient host, full of jokes and speedily delivered anecdotes. Veuve Clicquot and various fine wines flow freely, but Volandis drinks Pepsi Max. A can sits in front of him on the white linen cloth. To my left is Ben English, editor of the Daily Telegraph. A few places to the right is Volandis' blonde wife, Philippa, whom he married in 2003 when he was running the New South Wales Harness Racing Club. Volandis tells me they met because she rented a terrace house owned by the club, then based at Harold Park in Inner Sydney. When the house was burgled, Philippa stormed into the office to complain about the lack of bars on her windows. "She called me a slum landlord," he says, the left corner of his mouth turning up in a smile. The couple has three children, aged under 10. The entree is Alaskan crab ravioli, with grilled prawns and champagne chervil cream. Or, if that doesn't appeal, oriental five-spice Muscovy duck breast salad with pawpaw and ginger dressing. Volandis has neither dish. He prefers plain food. He's allergic to onions and garlic and is holding out for the bowls of chips he knows are on the way. He loves chips. "It's the Wollongong in me," he says. During the races, Volandis barracks loudly from his seat. He isn't a betting man, he says, but he likes to get into the spirit of things. "Juniper," he shouts, as a pack of horses hurtles up the home straight, all thundering hooves and glistening hides and streaming tails. "Go, Juniper!" The leaders flash over the finish line and Volandis whoops with delight. "Juniper won!" I didn't have a cent on it. As the afternoon progresses, he moves between tables, chatting to people, making introductions, working the room with practiced efficiency. News comes through that the American superstar slated to sing at the Melbourne Cup has cancelled her appearance. "Taylor Swift is a late scratching," Volandis announces, all but pumping his fist in the air. Swift's management team has blamed a scheduling conflict, but most assume her withdrawal is the result of a social media campaign questioning the ethics of horse racing and highlighting the recent string of fatalities associated with the Melbourne Cup. A five-year-old Irish stallion, the Cliffs of Moher, was euthanized on the Flemington track after breaking its shoulder during the race last year, becoming the sixth entrant to die since 2013. As Volandes is acutely aware, growing community concern about horse welfare is a serious threat to the racing industry. "You've got all these activists and extremists," he says. "They don't see how well the horses are looked after. They're looked after better than any pet. It's what happens to horses when they finish racing that Volandes says preoccupies him." He tells me that in New South Wales, he has introduced a program designed to ensure that they are put out to pasture and not sent to knackeries, for which he's imposed a 1% levy on prize money at race meetings. "Because I am a lover of the horse," he says earnestly. "Yeah, I love the horse. I gotta say, there's no one has more of an affection for horses than me." On Thursday night, weeks after that conversation, a shocking report on the ABC TV program 7:30 alleged thousands of registered racehorses were being killed in Australian slaughterhouses in contravention of racing rules and rehoming policies. On Friday, in an interview with Alan Jones, Volandes said he was appalled by video footage in the report showing sickening cruelty at a Queensland abattoir and that he hoped the perpetrators were brought to account. He said Racing New South Wales was the only state authority with a rule prohibiting horses from the thoroughbred racing industry being sent to knackeries or abattoirs, and that 99.9% of New South Wales horses that had retired since the rule was introduced 2 years ago had been rehomed. "We've bought properties all around New South Wales to rehome horses," he said. But Dr. Bitter Jones, acting chief executive of RSPCA Australia, disputes Volandes' assertion that retired horses in his jurisdiction aren't being sent to slaughter. He can't defend that claim because the systems aren't in place to ensure full traceability, Jones says. "They brought in the rule in New South Wales without having a system in place to actually implement that rule properly." She adds, "They've purchased properties for horses to retire on, but I haven't heard any information about how many horses are on those properties." In any case, Jones argues, the fate of racehorses is a national problem and the industry as a whole needs to take responsibility for it. "Too often, at the end of their profitable lives, they end up discarded," she says. "That's not what people who love horses would expect." In his time, Volandes was a handy rugby league player. "Peter was a very quick second rower," says Gary Jack, who as a teenager played with him for a Wollongong rugby league team, West's Red Devils. Jack went on to be a star player for the Balmain Tigers and New South Wales State of Origin sides. Volandes believes he too could have been a league professional. "Absolutely," he says. "I think I could have made it if I'd kept going. Because I was a pretty determined sort of person, and growing up, all I wanted to do was play for Australia in rugby league." His parents had made sacrifices to establish the family in their adopted country. "I still get emotional thinking about it," Volandes says. "My father would start work at 6 a.m. and wouldn't come home until midnight. He had the most miserable life. And my mother worked in a cafe from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. So as kids, we never saw them, basically." When Volandes started studying accountancy at Wollongong University, he supported himself by working in a pub. Aged just 19, he was promoted to manager. And by the time he was 20, he had saved the deposit required to buy the Courthouse Tavern, an old-fashioned eating house over the road from the Wollongong Courthouse. The restaurant's motto? You be the judge. He was studying, managing the restaurant, and working for an accountant. He didn't have time for rugby league as well, so he reluctantly quit the sport. Gary Jack says it was clear Volandes was going places. "He was always a thinker," Jack says. "He didn't talk as quick back in those days, but you always knew he was going to do something." The family name is actually spelt V-L-A-N-D-I-S. But from school days onwards, Peter spelt it V-L-A-N-D-Y-S. Asked why, he says in an offhand way that someone, maybe a teacher, I can't remember exactly who it was, told him this would help people with the pronunciation, Volandes. And I gotta say, it did make it easier for people to pronounce my name. As late as 1988, when he landed the job of harness racing boss, Volandis was convinced that his ethnic background counted against him. Trotting fans didn't all welcome him, he says. It was, why did they put the Greek bloke on? That sort of stuff. By 1997, when he appeared in a Film Australia documentary, The Gamblers, Volandis had not only stamped his authority at Harold Park, but learnt to deploy drollery to charm and disarm. In one scene, at a business meeting with people from outside the industry, he mentions the name of a champion trotter, Iracles. The others at the table look blank. Iracles, he repeats, with a glint in his eye. It's named after me, a Greek god. Racing Australia's Barry O'Farrell attributes Volandi's success to smarts, he's always more than three steps ahead, and hard work. This is a bloke who never switches off. Also, Volandis knows how to connect with the punters. I've walked through racetracks with him plenty of times, and he's like a grassroots politician, happy to stop and talk to people and get their feedback. At Racing New South Wales, the regulating body for the thoroughbred racing in the state, which he has headed since 2004, Volandis, in theory, answers to a board. In turn, the board reports to the New South Wales government. Some say that in reality he holds sway over the board, on which he has a seat, and has imposed his will on successive New South Wales premiers. Volandis and Racing New South Wales might deny it, says Max Presnell, racing writer for the Sydney Morning Herald and co-host of ABC Radio's Hoof on the Till. But he is answerable to nobody. This bloke is it. Racing in Sydney used to be run by the committees of wealthy racing clubs, as it still is in Melbourne. This system has largely been dismantled by Volandis, says James Mathers, a former committee member of the Australian Jockey Club, which in 2010 merged with the Sydney Turf Club to form the Australian Turf Club, the ATC. The restructure, pushed by Volandis, increased his control over the industry, Mathers contends. At the ATC, the committee seems to have little or no authority. All they really do is keep the pies warm and hand out the ribbons. Some say Volandis dominates the Racing New South Wales board for the simple reason that he knows more about racing than most of his fellow members, who are upstanding citizens from across the community. The chairperson, Russell Balding, is a former managing director of the ABC. Sheer force of personality might also have something to do with it. I have been with Peter in boardroom meetings, says Greg Rudolph, a former senior Racing New South Wales executive. And he is very powerful in getting his point across. He will fight tooth and nail for what he believes is the right outcome. Rudolph worked closely with Volandis during the equine influenza outbreak that brought the racing industry to its knees in 2007. He remembers the widespread relief when Volandis saved the day by convincing the then Prime Minister, John Howard, to grant a $235 million rescue package. Howard, recalling their meeting, tells me that Volandis put to him a compelling case for government assistance. He's an intelligent, competent man who presents his arguments well. If polite persuasion doesn't work, Volandis uses other tactics. Soon after Mike Baird became New South Wales Premier in 2014, Volandis went to see him to argue that the state's tax on racing wagering was too high and should be lowered from $3.22 per $100 on totalisator bets to the Victorian tax rate of $1.28. Baird did not agree, and the pair reportedly clashed in the Premier's office. A person close to Baird says Volandis then reverted to the normal levers and got the media to bash up on government for not giving racing a fair go. The Daily Telegraph, published by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, campaigned energetically for a reduction in the New South Wales racing tax, and in a radio interview before the 2015 New South Wales state election, Alan Jones lit into Baird for not committing to a better deal for New South Wales racing. Baird's re-elected Liberal National Coalition government eventually introduced wagering tax parity legislation. Baird, now a National Australia Bank executive, declined to comment. Volandi's media strategy is said to be two-pronged. He wines and dines media executives, and he hectors racing reporters. To me, he denies that he oversteps the mark. We tell him what we'd like him to write, which is what the readers want to read, he says. Race previews and so on. But what they write is up to them. Ken Callender resigned from the Daily Telegraph in 2015 after a long and distinguished career as a racing writer because he felt increasingly pressured to refrain from criticising Volandi's and Racing New South Wales. His manipulation of the press is incredible, says Callender, emphasising that like fellow journalist Max Presnell, he has plenty of respect for Volandi's. I take my hat off to the man. He's done some marvellous things for racing. It's just that Volandi seems to Callender to have an unhealthy grip on the city's newspapers. They're all beholden to him because of commercial relationships. Like the Daily Telegraph, the Sydney Morning Herald is paid by Racing New South Wales to publish form guides, though the sum is said to be considerably smaller. Paul Whittaker, chief executive of Sky News Australia, who was editor of the Daily Telegraph when Callender quit, categorically denies that the paper's editorial independence was compromised in any way. But Callender believes Volandi's path to the top rugby league job was smoothed by favourable press coverage. He's had the softest run in the media of any sporting figure in my time, he says. Outgoing Australian Rugby League Commission chairman Peter Beattie is blithely unconcerned when I mention to him that some people I have interviewed maintain that the Telegraph, in particular, dances to Volandi's tune. My response to that is whoopee-doo, Beattie says. If he's got news in his pocket, is that a bad thing for us? Even if it is true, where's the downside for rugby league? In Volandi's most celebrated win for the racing industry, he went all the way to the High Court to ensure that corporate bookmakers such as Sportsbet and betting exchange Betfair were compelled to pay Racing New South Wales a percentage of their wagering turnover. Since that victory in 2012, about $1 billion has flowed to the New South Wales industry, and the precedent has been followed in other states. During the protracted legal battle, Volandi's came under sustained personal attack, portrayed by critics in such a negative light that he has said, "It got to a situation where I got home and the cat kicked me, rather than me kicking the cat." I tell him I have heard that he directs Racing New South Wales lawyers to fire off a lot of letters threatening to sue people for defamation. "I wouldn't say it was that many," he protests. But yes, he believes in defending his reputation if he regards criticism as unfair. You've got to protect yourself. And that's all I do. Central Western New South Wales trainer Debbie Prest, who describes herself on her Twitter account as a big old country Sheila who pulls no punches, has been summoned to appear at an inquiry by Racing New South Wales stewards into comments she posted last month about Volandi's and the Racing New South Wales board. The gist of the remarks was that the board was weak to allow Volandi's to take on the rugby league job when he was being paid to work full-time as the Racing New South Wales chief executive. Prest has previously accused Volandi's of allowing country tracks and training facilities to fall into disrepair. "They can deem that anything I put on social media is inappropriate," she says. "I can be fined, I can lose my licence. This is why people are so scared." It seems to Tim Egan, chief executive of the Newcastle Provincial and Country Trainers Association, that there is something wrong with a system in which stewards, employed by Volandi's and Racing New South Wales, act as police, judge and jury, laying charges, determining guilt or innocence, then imposing a penalty. "The effect is to silence dissenting voices in the industry," says Egan. Newcastle trainer Peter Eggleston agrees. "Anyone sticks their head up, this bloke will cut it off." Karen Fox, a Victorian trainer who 6 years ago moved to Tamworth in New South Wales, says she was taken aback to discover how powerful Volandi's was. It is so wrong that anyone, be they good, bad or indifferent, has the control that he has over an industry this size, Fox says. Racing directly employs about 70,000 Australians. It is not just a sport, but a multi-billion dollar business. Yet by all accounts, Volandis runs the Racing New South Wales head office like a strapped-for-cash charity operating out of a church basement. The stationery cupboard is monitored. If you want to make a colour photocopy as opposed to black and white, you need permission from your manager. Within the CBD, there is no catching cabs. To get to a meeting, you go on foot. I lead by example, Volandis says cheerfully. If it's a 25-minute walk, so be it. Volandis' office, which is said to be fantastically untidy, I don't get to see it, is off limits to the cleaners. I do my own vacuuming, he tells me, as if this were quite a common arrangement. There's confidential information there, so I've got my own vacuum cleaner. I do it in the mornings. Says Barry O'Farrell, he does have some control freak genes. When I ask former Racing New South Wales chief steward Ray Murrahy whether Volandis is a popular figure in the industry, he replies, I think everyone would acknowledge certainly his achievements. Trainer Gay Waterhouse also dodges the question of his lovability. He's probably the most tenacious person I've ever known, she says. But actor Brian Brown is keen to talk about his longtime friend. A pretty great bloke, the old Volandis, he says. The best sort of dag. Brown and his wife, the director and actor Rachel Ward, met Volandis 26 years ago when they asked him if they could hold a fundraiser for the Sydney City Mission at Harold Park. Without hesitation, he said, absolutely, says Brown, who in the rugby league season accompanies Volandis to St George Illawarra Dragons matches and occasionally accepts invitations to his lunches at Royal Randwick. He knows I have no interest in the races, but he demands that I turn up. At the last one Brown attended, someone was celebrating a birthday. Volandis called on the actor to lead the tributes. He just puts it on you. Brian Brown's going to sing Happy Birthday. At my lunch, Volandis broke into song himself. One minute he was lamenting the hate that spews forth on social media. The next, he was crooning Glen Campbell's Try a Little Kindness. Brown laughs when I tell him this. He's a dill, the actor says. The Everest works differently from most other horse races. There are 12 slot holders who have paid $600,000 each to pick their own runner to compete in the 1,200-metre sprint. Amanda Elliott has called it a novelty race. But Melbourne Racing Club chief executive Josh Blanksby has so wholeheartedly embraced the concept that his club has secured one of the slots. We think it will be a really big boom, he says, of this afternoon's racing. The Everest is scheduled for 4:15 p.m. The Caulfield Cup an hour later. All eyes will be on those two big races. Of the two spring carnivals, Victoria's remains furlongs in front, with 21 Group 1, the highest level races, compared with only 7 in New South Wales, and 16 races offering prize money of $1 million or more, compared with 10 in New South Wales. But Blanksby regards Volandis as racing's sharpest operator. His ability to work both the government and media to get positive outcomes for racing has been pretty extraordinary. Chris Waller, best known for training the champion horse Winx, agrees. He's shaken up Australian racing, and the rest of the world is watching, Waller says. Nowhere else in the world is prize money going up like it is in New South Wales. More than that, says Waller, he's a very good person. I know from my own experience. He's checked on my welfare and well-being at different times. There are very few people who knock on the door and say, how are things going? Volandis makes clear that he is fond of Waller because, like him, the leading trainer started from scratch. When he first came to Australia from New Zealand, he had 20 cents in his pocket, Philandes says. Couldn't train a jasmine up a trellis. And look at them both now. Philandes remembers being a small boy standing in the front yard of his family's fibro cottage in Wollongong, watching the world go by. Sometimes I think to myself, am I still the same person? It's weird how life treats you.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland and I'm the editor of Good Weekend magazine. Joining me today for a discussion about Peter Philandes is Jane Cadzow, senior writer with Good Weekend, and Andrew Webster, chief sports writer with the Sydney Morning Herald. Welcome, Jane and Andrew.
Thank you, Katrina.
Thank you, Katrina. Great to be here.
Andrew, let's start with you. Horse racing has not stopped through the coronavirus pandemic and rugby league will be the first contact sport back when the season resumes on May 28. Peter Philandes, as we know, is CEO of Racing New South Wales and chairman of the NRL. So is it sheer force of personality that means he tends to push things through that others might not, given he's a two of the sports that are still going or about to start?
I think it'd be fair to describe Peter Philandes as a force of nature. He usually gets what he wants, and he's certainly been that way in horse racing for a long time. Racing's continued in New South Wales mainly because it's a very strictly enforced sport as it is. But when it comes to rugby league, he was very adamant from the very start. As soon as the game basically went down into lockdown after round two, he was already working around getting a May or a late May restart, and then he was getting everyone to bend around him, whether it was the state governments or federal government, health authorities, clubs, whoever. He was going to get back on May 28, no matter what anyone else said, no matter what the AFL said or any other sports. So, as I said, he is a force of nature. I think they will make a musical about Peter Philandes one day and just how belligerent he is in getting what he wants.
It seems interesting, though, isn't it, that when he first started talking about late May, a lot of people thought he was crazy and that he was being way too bullish and that it would all kind of come back in his face. But now it seems that maybe he was a bit prescient. Do you agree with May 28? Do you think that's too early, or do you think that actually, as it turns out, he's got it about right?
I thought it was madness when it was first announced that was the flagpole that they were trying to get to. I remember talking to the very first biosecurity expert that the NRL engaged, and she only spoke on the promise of anonymity, and she was the one who decided to ground the competition on the basis of a few things. Mainly it was the Ruby Princess debacle and also those scenes that we saw at Bondi Beach where there was 20,000 people not observing social distancing that much, and she just thought that the spike was going to be much higher than what everyone anticipated. That's why she thought the competition should be stopped. Philandes took her advice on board, but almost within hours of her giving that advice, he was adamant that they should go again before the end of May. And like everybody, I was sceptical. Like a lot of people, I thought it was reckless. But I have to say, you know, whether you like it or not, he's got the authority from both state and federal governments and from health authorities to do it. If he's not fulfilling them, I think it would be ridiculous for him to be doing so. But given that he's been given the go-ahead from, you know, the highest officers in the land, who's to say that it shouldn't be going ahead?
And it's now only 2 weeks ahead of the AFL, so not that far ahead, really.
No, but the AFL they've been looking down their nose at Peter Philandes and rugby league like they often do, and now all of a sudden he's painted them into a corner where they have to be back. Otherwise they're going to be giving the NRL so much free airtime as the only major football code that's restarted again. So love him or not, he can get the job done, and he's putting the Uber professional AFL under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of pressure from people, even within their own. Even coaches have come out, people like Damien Hardwick and other sort of big names within AFL have been saying, well, if the NRL's going, then why aren't we? So it's been interesting to see the NRL, which is often seen as an amateurish sport compared to the Australian Football League, putting pressure on the bigger code.
And Jane, you profiled him. Does this all fit with the person that you met and got a sense of?
Yeah, absolutely it does. I mean, he is such an operator, you know, and he sort of doesn't take no for an answer. That's what people I interviewed said to me about him. He decides on a course of action and he just, he gets there somehow.
What most surprised you about him, and did you find him likeable?
Well, the thing that surprised me most about him was that I did find him likeable. Before I met him, I'd read a lot about him and spoken to a lot of people, and I understood that he was super tough, you know, sort of human bulldozer, shouted over the top of people in meetings. I actually found him really fun to be with, and he said that almost everyone who meets him has the same reaction. They say, you're not nearly as bad as we expected
you to be. If he does say
so
himself.
Yeah. he's actually really funny. Doesn't make me disbelieve at all the things that I heard about people saying, you do not want to get on his wrong side. You know, all of that is clearly true, but he's an extremely engaging character to talk to, partly because he's completely unpretentious. You know, I think he quite likes the sort of I'm the Sydney Spiv thing, you know, and so he quite likes taking on Melbourne, whether it's horse racing or AFL.
Andrew, that fits with your perception as well?
That's exactly how I would describe him as well. There's a great line in your piece, Jane, about where Brian Brown, the actor, and he calls him a dag, and that's exactly how I would describe Peter Volandis. He's a dag. He doesn't have the best suit. He's always got his shirt untucked, his tie askew, you know, running around like a headless chook, but he always gets the job done. And he, I called him early on. He answered the phone, Edmund Hillary. He's a dag. He is just a dag. And unashamedly so, but I think that's part of his shtick, to be perfectly honest. He likes people to underestimate him. They think that he's a bit of a bogan. He's also got an ability to brush off criticism, to brush off all the brickbats that come his way. Now, only a few weeks ago, he was adamant that he had exemptions for the New Zealand Warriors to come into the country and play. Not once but twice in the 1 week, the Prime Minister of the country said that's not the case. Yet they still, within a couple of days, got the exemption that he was talking about. Now, only someone like Peter Volandis could get slapped down publicly by the Prime Minister in the space of 4 or 5 days and still just keep on going.
Jane, did you get the sense that he enjoys the kind of biffo and the taking on Melbourne for the sake of the trouble, or is it kind of all about the competitiveness of making sure the thing that he's running wins?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I think he definitely enjoys conflict. Somebody I interviewed for the profile said, you know, if things are a bit quiet, he goes looking for a fight. It sort of invigorates him. I would think he would have just been kind of loving all this stuff about when rugby league was going to be able to get going again. I think he, you know, loves being in the centre of action and crisis and calling the shots. He's really ready to take people on, you know, and I think he probably loves being the person who, you know, is now at the sort of top of the tree.
And what do you feel like drives him? Did you or Andrew, either of you, have a sense of what it is that has driven him to these kind of levels?
Well, I think, you know, what I was just saying about the, you know, the boy from Wollongong, he's always, you know, telling you that he's from Wollongong and his father worked double shifts at the steel factory. And, you know, he said his parent, he's very emotional talking about his family and what a hard life they had. And I just think he's sort of thrilled that he's such a success. And actually in quite, you know, he's not arrogant at all, but he sort of appreciates it, you know, and he said, you know, he sort of pinches himself and thinks, am I the same person as that boy in Wollongong? So I think there's an element of that.
He certainly likes being told he can't do something, particularly if it's someone from Melbourne who's said that he can't do something. If you look at the Everest race, He launched that with 7 months before it was due to start, and people looked down their nose at him again and said that there's no way that it's going to happen, and he was going to attract some of the best sprinters in the country, and he was going to get slot owners, and this $10 million, you know, miracle race that no one said was going to happen, and if it did, it was going to be a flop. Well, it happened. He got some of the best racehorses in the country entering in it, and he also got more than 35,000 at Royal Randwick for the first time in years, even since Black Caviar was going around. So, you know, and ever in the subsequent years since then, there's been crowds of 40,000 people at Randwick for the Everest race. It's just been a complete phenomenon. So I think he likes people underestimating him and him proving them wrong.
Jane, you noted in the piece that he calls rugby rugby league, and that really struck a chord. I noticed I was listening to a radio interview recently with two sports journalists, and they kept on calling it rugby league as well. That's always a fine line, isn't it? Like when is it observation and when is it ridicule?
Well, it obviously depends on so much on the circumstance. If you've got the person who is in charge of rugby league in Australia and he just pronounces it in that curious way, it would be kind of odd not to note it, really, I thought. I mean, I did sort of think about that. You wouldn't kind of want to be laughing at him. It's just, and I wasn't, actually. I just thought it was kind of interesting. And he's a powerful person. He's a tough person. You know, I knew I wasn't going to hurt his feelings. He's, you know, definitely no way, you know. So I just thought it was odd. I don't know why he says it that way.
Oh, there's a story that's come out since then. Like, ever since Jane's outstanding piece, I'd interviewed Peter Verlandis dozens of times and never picked up on it. But every time I spoke to him since that Good Weekend piece, I became obsessed with how many times he said rugby league. He held a live press conference there on the Sunday when rugby league decided that it was going to go ahead. In that live press conference, he said it so often that my phone was lining up from people watching it at home saying, can he pronounce the name of the game correctly? I've seen a story subsequently appeared since then where it's actually a nod to his Greek background where the G is apparently silent. I don't know how true that is. It's very curious. They say the G is silent. I can definitely hear him saying rugby league.
It's interesting also, isn't it, that relationship between administrators and the journalists who report on it. And there does seem to be a sense, Andrew, that he's got the media wrapped around his finger. Where does that perception come from and how accurate is it?
There's always been a lot of speculation about his close relationship with News Limited and / News Corp, because over a long period of time, Racing New South Wales has spent a huge amount of money with their form guides and fields. They have a similar deal with the Sydney Morning Herald, but to a far, far lesser extent money-wise. But I just think mainly, and I've seen it throughout this COVID-19 crisis in rugby league, he is exceptionally good at fostering his relationships with reporters, whether they are a cadet or a senior columnist. He picks up the phone to any journalist that calls. He makes them feel special. He'll keep them informed. He'll get back to them if he doesn't pick up after three rings, he'll get back to them within 3 minutes. And he just fosters those relationships very carefully. Throughout this whole crisis, he's been very, very good at getting on the front foot. And there hasn't been many people that have taken him on and questioned the decisions that he's made. I'm happy to say that I've been one of them. But when you do, you get such a wild reaction from the reader saying that you're anti-rugby league. To praise him, you get accused of being in his back pocket. But in terms of reporters, not many will take him on. And if you do, you have to be prepared for a bit of a backlash.
Yeah, I found him, you know, I mean, he was extremely nice to me because I was writing a profile about him, I guess. You know, people do tend to be nice. And, you know, I think he is, as I was saying, an engaging personality. But people did tell me that he, you know, has a reputation for ringing up and hectoring racing writers who don't write what he wants them to write. I asked him about that and he said, oh, we don't tell them what to write, but we just know what people want to read. You know, there is definitely an element of, I think, probably making life unpleasant for people who don't promote racing.
Andrew, there was a lot of talk when Peter Verlandis took over the NRL as chairman that it was a conflict with him as CEO of Racing New South Wales. Is there a conflict with the one powerful person running two sports?
Yeah, he is. That's the position that he's assumed. Look, before COVID kicked in and when Volandis first became chairman back in October last year, there was a few of us, particularly the Herald, who raised concerns about him running two major sports, and in the case of racing, a sport that brings in huge amounts of money. That's been put on the back burner in many respects because of the COVID crisis, and he's had to step up and do whatever he could to keep rugby league going. It became very clear when COVID first started that the money didn't really have that much in the back pocket for a rainy day, and now it was pouring and rugby league was looking like it was going to wither on the vine if it didn't get take some drastic action like getting back on the field. So that issue has sort of has faded into the background. He is adamant that he doesn't want to become executive chairman. I'm not convinced that he doesn't want that job as executive chairman. I think it's an issue that will pop up towards the end of the season when things settle down, and then you're going to have real conflict of interest issues. And it won't be the people in rugby league so much complaining about it, but I would dare say it's the people in racing who, over the last couple of weeks, have seen, particularly Racing New South Wales, has been a revolving door of rugby league people coming into Racing New South Wales's offices to meet with Peter Volandis, and they're sitting there going, well, is it your main job to be looking after racing?
Ultimately, is he a force for good or evil? Perhaps we'll ask you first, Andrew, in the sports that he controls.
Oh, that's a nice easy question there, Katrina. I'll say, you know what? I think having known the man for quite a few years now, I think he's got a good heart. I really do. I think if you watched Peter Volandis the musical, you'd walk away thinking he's a good guy.
Well, I agree. That's what I thought. I thought that underneath all that palaver, that he is a good person. It's a feeling you get if you spend some time with people. I know he's really tough. I really wouldn't want to be on his wrong side. Everyone said that to me. You do not want to be on his wrong side. But I think underneath it, he is a good person.
And is he the classic person who was bullied who turned into a bully?
Somebody said that to me. You know, you'd have to, if you're going to indulge in some amateur psychology, you would have to kind of think so. He really, the whole thing about being bullied at school, I mean, a lot of people, I guess, were bullied at school, but it's sort of fresh in his mind, it seems. And he does talk about it. And I feel like, it plays into the person he is. But as Andrew says, he's a kind of a kind and generous person in other ways too. I think he enjoys being able to be magnanimous, you know, and have 80 people for lunch at Royal Randwick, even if it's also part of his, networking and always working towards a goal. I think he likes being at the centre of all of that.
And just one final question for you, Andrew. What's next for him? What do you see him having his eye on, or do you think he's kind of got to the top of where he wants to be now?
It's a really interesting question, Katrina. I can definitely see him taking on that executive chairman role of the game later this year. He's got a get-out clause out of his current deal with Racing Australia, and I just think, you know, he's worked his way up in sports administration from the bottom all the way up to, you know, chairman of one of the two major sports in this country, one of the two major football codes in this country. And I could see him being chief executive or executive chairman of rugby league being the pinnacle for him. I don't know if politics, I've talked to him many times about going into state or federal politics, and he laughs at it and says, no, I don't know how Canberra would handle someone like Peter Volandis. But I can definitely see him running rugby league as on a full-time basis in the future.
That's right. And he's certainly the kind of complex character that makes for a great Good Weekend feature. So thank you, Jane, for your fantastic piece. And thank you, Andrew, for the conversation.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks, Katrina.
Thanks, Katrina. Thanks, Andrew.
Good Weekend Talks is brought to you by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance from Conrad Marshall and technical assistance from Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.